This is the Stamfords podcast at the Stamfords Travel Writers Festival at Destinations in Olympia.
And without further ado, please welcome with Julia Wheeler, Colin Thubron.
Do you want to pop that back up? Something. I'll create a diversion while you do that. Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and a very warm welcome to the Stamfords Travel Writers Festival, and in particular to this lovely event. I'm delighted to welcome to the stage one of Britain's most eloquent and evocative travel writers, someone who's taken us to all the corners of the world with his magical prose. We've travelled with him among the Russians in the former Soviet Union and behind the wall in China, more recently in the shadow of the Silk Road and to a mountain in Tibet. He's also admired for his fiction, and his latest novel, Night of Fire, has plenty of travel in it as well, within its pages. So, ladies and gentlemen, once again, please welcome Colin Thubron. Now, Colin, on the back of your latest novel, Night of Fire, is the phrase, "It began with a spark." And I wonder whether you could tell us where your spark came from in terms of the travel writing.
I think it initially came because my parents were working, when I was a small boy, my parents were working in Canada and the States, and I was sent back to England to school and holidays in Canada, and this was a long time ago. In the late 40s, which is when this was happening, I was having this exciting childhood in Canada and the States, and then I was going back to a miserable school in the sort of gorse bushes of Ascot, and I very early, I think, came to think that school, home was boring, abroad was wonderful and interesting. After all, it wasn't that long after the end of the Second World War when there was hardly a neon light to be seen in England, and suddenly you were in Times Square among the great lakes of Canada. And so, of course, I think that's maybe where it began.
So it's that polarity between, that post-war austerity, I guess, in England and all those bright lights. And so people say, in terms of a career, find something that you love to do and then find someone to pay you to do it. And that's the kind of dream scenario. How did you go about making that happen?
not very competently. I started in publishing because I felt I wanted to be a writer rather than a traveller, both. But at the age of 19, at the age of 19, you don't have anything much to write about. And I went into publishing thinking that if I fail as a writer, I'll become a publisher. And so I had 4 years in publishing. Then I suddenly realised that time was slipping by. I felt totally old when I was 24. And I thought, this is the enemy, I've got to break away. And I just went to Damascus and settled there with an Arab family, having been passionately interested in urban Arab culture, not really the Bedouin. And it began from there, really. That was the beginning. But in a way, you take a risk, obviously. You've got to take a lot of time out of your life to write a book. But I was unattached at the time, and it happened to work.
And why Damascus? Had you learnt Arabic before, or did you sort of go fairly green?
This is a moment of shame, because I never learnt Arabic. I had tourist Arabic only, and I'm still ashamed of it. But I went, and I had briefly, almost as a student, been in Damascus, and I was just fascinated by what I didn't understand. I think all my travel books have been about not understanding, the attempt to understand something which you feel actually is mysterious. It's being sort of withheld from you. And Damascus in particular, like a lot of the old cities of Syria, still are, you go through these alleyways which are sort of mud walls, and there's you can go on and get a feeling of being excluded from everything. Somebody leaves a door open then, and you look in, and there's in the case of Damascus, or the old Aleppo, it would be a basalt and marble-paved courtyard and a lemon tree and somebody doing something mysterious a bit beyond. And I realised I didn't even know what a mosque really was. Mm. And so the whole business of being in Damascus was a rather romantic act of discovery.
Just need you to move the microphone just slightly nearer to your mouth, so that.
Sorry. Nobody's probably heard a word.
I think they have, but.
What do you think that's doing?
Is that a bit better?
Can you hear me?
Maybe we'll project. No. I'll tell you what, we'll project a little more.
Okay.
So that was 1967.
Oh, okay.
I'll be Madonna.
So that was 1967 when Mirror to Damascus was published.
Yeah.
Mirror on Damascus.
Mirror to Damascus.
Mirror to Damascus was published. Yeah. Does that hold a special place in your heart, that book, because it was the first one?
Yes, I think that happens with almost all professional travel writers, that the first book you write, because of the energy, the youthful enthusiasm, the naivety that goes with it, it has a special place, and Damascus certainly does.
Yes, and when was the last time you were able to go back to Damascus?
Oh, I've hardly been back since. I'm hoping to go in a few weeks' time if the Syrian Foreign Ministry will allow me, because it's the 50th anniversary of that book's publication, and I'd like to write a new introduction to it. I don't know if I'll be allowed back, but there's a chance.
But if you are, that's going to be a very emotional journey, isn't it, given the circumstances there at the moment?
Yes, I think, oddly enough, I think one of the things is what's going to be unrecognisable to me is not that they're going to be security police and an army at every street corner, but the fact of how westernised it's become. They're sort of boutique hotels and all everything that happened in Damascus while Lebanon was in a state of war was a westernisation. It benefited from Beirut being off the economic map, and Damascus developed tremendously when I was not there. And I think that's what may shock me, actually. It's westernization rather than war, but I'll see.
You've been drawn, I guess, as a thread that runs through your work, and you've said this yourself, to places that you perhaps feel threatened by or that you didn't understand. What has been that pull? Why?
I don't really know. It's awfully hard. You sort of imagine that you know why you do things, but it was quite unconscious. I think, I was brought up to fear Russia, all my generation, just as my parents' generation were brought up to fear Germany. My generation was brought up to fear the Soviet Union and the great yellow peril of China behind it. And I think I had an instinct to kind of people the map with experiences of my own, human beings who I could relate to. It wasn't a conscious act of trying to give my readers a feeling that Russia was human and China was comprehensible. It was much more just an instinct of something that I wanted to do. For some reason, I've always wanted challenge in my books. I've always wanted to be to something rather that will give me the feeling that what I bring back in terms of contact, such little understanding as I may get, or of talking to the people of a country, that it has a sort of value. And obviously, if you go to somewhere like Russia and China, particularly in the remoter parts of it, those conversations hold something that's unusual, and would seem to have an importance that, say, going to France does not.
And in terms of language with Russia and China, are you more proud of your efforts there than in Arabic?
Yes. I've struggled with them all my life, with Russian and Mandarin, two very different languages, and I can't say I speak either well, but I've tried to get them to the point at which I can get people's stories, if you like.
And trust your own translation.
Yes.
Yeah.
But a lot of it, particularly in Mandarin, is sitting with somebody saying, do you mean that? Did you mean that? Could you please repeat? So almost all the conversations that I record in my books are one-on-one because I've needed to know. In any case, I think personal conversations, one-on-one, even in our own society, if you want to have an intimate conversation with somebody, if there are three of you, it falls to bits. It has to be two.
In Among the Russians, one of the first people that you meet in Minsk is a sort of official guide who wants to give you lots and lots of information and lots of facts and figures and is very proud of things. But you say that actually you prefer as a traveller and as a writer to take notice of the smiles on the children's faces and whether the cats run away. How important is that in terms of if you're writing and impressions and so on when you get back, in terms of what you include in your writing?
I think travel writing has the benefit of being all-inclusive in a way. It's not like an academic tome that's steered in one particular direction. You're hoping, at least in my travel writing, I'm hoping to give a picture of a culture which includes not just the grandeurs of history or the glories of architecture, but exactly those incidental things which make up ordinary life, whether it's a bit of graffiti or whether it's, you know, a strange dog or even a very chance conversation. So all those things have an importance. I mean, they amount to the sort of, I suppose you could say, the sort of sensuous impact of a country rather than just the logical understanding of it, what it feels to be there, its smells, its sights, you know, the chance things as well as those that you've planned for.
And I wonder how you make the links. I can imagine that you have these chance encounters and it seems something fairly ephemeral to start with, but because something perhaps happens later on in the journey, that may become important in the overall telling of a place. If you think about it in literary terms, the sort of story arc.
I think that may be unintentional. What happens is, during a conversation, I find you may be having a perfectly ordinary conversation with, you know, a Russian farmer or a Chinese fisherman or something, and suddenly something clicks, and in a horrid, unromantic, journalistic way, you realise you can use this. It sounds awful, but you are in fact using them, and there's something unusual about the talk, something that's illuminating, something that's just quirky, and it always happens quite definite, or virtually always. It's quite a definite feeling I have during the course of such a conversation that suddenly this one means something.
Like a scoop, a journalist would say.
Yeah.
So which for you is more important, the journey or the destination?
It has to be the journey. A journey has many destinations as you are travelling. And while I'm researching a book, I usually begin to know the places that are going to interest me, that are going in some way to speak for the culture, and so it's a whole thread of destinations. But the point of the book is something different. I don't know that always until it's over.
Mm-hmm. And I guess in terms of keeping the drive through something, often there needs to be a destination. There needs to be a goal.
Yes, I find there are many goals actually.
In terms of the reader to pick up on, to keep turning the pages. Almost.
Yes, I mean, this is one of the great problems of a travel book, is that really it consists of a whole lot of encounters and reflections, which may not have any very obvious logic, except that they are strung together by this first person, this travelling eye. So you may go, say, from a piece of history to a chance conversation, to a landscape description, to a piece of architecture, to another conversation, and they are all, they should all have the illusion, at least, of some sort of continuity and some kind of drive. A reader has to feel that this is not just really a random journey. It has some point and purpose and tension in it. So that you have to build up. But I don't always know what the purpose of the journey is until it's over. Mm-hmm. then you look back and you can see themes, and sometimes it happens during the course of the journey that you suddenly think, yes, of course, that's what's gripping me. During the course of writing a book on China, for instance, I realized that it was the Cultural Revolution, this was 1980s, was obsessing me, the aftermath of the Cultural Revolution, the cruelty, really, that had obtained at that time. At other times, you finish a journey, and you look back and you say, oh, yes, that's what that meant. I did a long journey along the Silk Road for 9 months, and it was only at the end that I realized that every so-called national border on the map was false, ethnically false. There were the actual distribution of peoples bore very, very little relation to the physical map. But that was realized after the journey. Other times, you realize with research what the journey is going to be about before you go at all. It just depends.
And if you haven't found that destination, that goal, that what that journey is about, do you find that you're more tense when you're on the journey, or have you come to trust yourself and relax into it so that you know that something will come up for you?
I usually trust that something's going to come up, that it's going to have a shape. But the tension in all my travels has been to meet people. What you fear is that you're not going to have any insight into the country because you're not going to meet people who are not people that have been, you know, introduced to you from England or something. They're not people who are expert in their country. They're examples, if you like, of their culture. In other words, often quite humble people. And that's the fear in my case. I'm not going to have those sort of conversations. You know that certain things are going to be there. You know the history is there waiting for you, the architecture, the landscape. You can be sure of getting there. What you can't know is what's going to happen to you along the way.
Which is part of the absolute delight, I should imagine, as well.
Yes.
Yeah. So one of your most recent travel book, To a Mountain in Tibet, you say at the beginning that you weren't even sure that you were going to write a book based on this journey. And in it, it's very much almost as much memoir as it is travel writing in some ways. Tell us about give us a little bit of a sense of that book and how it perhaps differs from the others.
That was unusual, I think. Most of my books, people have accused me of being too reticent about myself during. They say, we never really know much about you. This one was much more personal and was, I think, it was really spurred by the death of my mother. My family, I suddenly had no family. My sister died long ago. My father was dead. My mother, and I had an instinct to move, as some people do. It's almost like a sort of secular pilgrimage, if you like, if that's not a contradiction in terms. And I didn't know. It was something I wanted to do. I took notes along the way, as it were, like a diary, but I wasn't sure there was going to be a book in there. Then I found I was writing. A bit about my parents, even about my sister, and I thought as I was writing them that I'll leave these out. They're too personal, they're not going to interest anybody anyway. And then I realized that they were actually integral to the book itself, which was a journey to the Buddhist Hindu mountain of Mount Kailash in Tibet. And so I was journeying in a way towards a sort of mountain that was sacred to a culture that wasn't my own. I mean, a beautiful object in the landscape, if you like, which was could be said to be sacred, whatever that means.
Yeah, what is the significance of it? Why is it such an important mountain?
It relates to early scriptures, Hindu Buddhist scriptures, who believe in this Mount Kailash as being the sort of turning point of the world. And the idea, their feeling is that the four great rivers that nourish the world flow from this mountain. And this idea became associated with this geographical mountain, which sits just to the north of the main Himalayan range in Tibet. It stands alone, very beautiful, very striking. And indeed, the four great rivers that nourish southern Asia all have their sources there by almost a fluke, the Brahmaputra, the Ganges, the Indus, and so on. So it's become sacred to many faiths, in fact, the Jain, the Hindu, the Buddhist, so on.
And tell us about some of the people, perhaps particularly the monks that you met along the way, and the other pilgrims.
Well, the pilgrims, unfortunately, and this is where I get very frustrated, I couldn't talk to, I can't speak Tibetan. And so I was having to often imagine what was happening, what they were doing. But I realized in a way that the whole mountain was sacred. It wasn't as if there was a particular shrine there. They believe that Shiva, the Hindus believe that Shiva lives, has his palace on top of the mountain and so on. But actually, the way they were treating the mountain pilgrims was that every stone, every minor peak around it, every valley had its story and was sacred.
You say at one point that you don't quite envy the monks, their sort of lack of sense of inheritance, because it's something that you've just been dealing with in terms of going through your mother's and your father's things that they've left, and that how different that is in the Buddhist tradition. Just tell us a little bit about how you've woven into your writing that mix of what was going on in the mountain and what was going on physically, perhaps for you during the journey, with your thoughts of back home and your whole life and your parents' life.
Well, these are sort of, it's like recording in a way what's going on in your mind while you're on this so-called pilgrimage. Some of it was incidental, some of it spurred by something. I mean, my father had been in the army in India, a few mountains away, hunting big game, to my mother's disgust. And that obviously occurred to me. Another sadder thing that occurred to me was that Mount Kailash, on one face of it, is said to resemble the mountain scene from Grindelwald, where my sister died. And that was very potent to me. So some of these things happen because of the geography of the place, others simply because that's what I was feeling along the way.
And one of the feelings you had was that someone, perhaps your sister, was just ahead of you.
Yes, it's a fantasy. It was a feeling that some people do have travelling in mountains. I didn't have this precisely, but I've known from people that are mountaineers, they sometimes have the idea that there is somebody just beside them. Somebody else.
Yeah. So let's turn to talk about your latest book, which is Night of Fire, which is fiction. But there's plenty of travel in there, isn't there? And you did a fair bit of travelling for research. Where did you go to?
I went, my first time I'd ever been to sub-Saharan Africa. I went to a refugee camp in Malawi. I went to Varanasi in India to the cremation grounds of Benares. I went to Simla and I went to Mount Athos in northern Greece. These were just some of the destinations. And really, they were there because of the impact they have on individuals in the books. They all have they're not just decoration, they have a purpose, and what foreign places, alien places, what effect they have on different personalities in the book.
And is your process when you're researching for fiction the same as it would be if you knew that you were going to write a travel book afterwards, or do you behave and take different types of notes?
No, I feel quite differently about it. With a travel book, I'm trying to forget myself in order to understand where I am. You can't do it, of course. It's an awful fallacy that you can leave your culture behind. But I try to, in the effort to understand, I've attempted to eliminate myself. Travelling for fiction, you're travelling in the persona of the characters in your book. And so you're taking on their sensibility, their purposes, their character, their limitations, and imagining yourself, what it's like to be somebody else in this environment. So it's not you, it's them.
And in Malawi, you've said that, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but it was slightly voyeuristic to be there and that actually you felt uncomfortable being in that situation because you were researching for fiction.
Yes, it's very uncomfortable. You feel rather like a war photographer that is photographing some horror, and for his purposes in a way. But it's one worse than that, because your purpose is a fiction. You're not even reporting back something for a news-hungry media that has happened, and that can have an ethical value. With fiction, with a novel, it's rather more complicated. You're using them for purposes that you're going to transmute into something else, and particularly in a refugee camp. And this was a pretty grim one, but it was hard. But of course, you nevertheless need it in order to understand anything. I couldn't have written this book without going, or that section of it, without going to a refugee camp. All the things that you imagine you might understand from looking at a television screen or even reading a book are nothing compared with the experience of being there on the ground.
So we've talked a bit about the process behind it. Give us a sense of the book. What's it about?
This is going to sound very pretentious. It's terribly hard to write about to talk about fiction. It's much easier to talk about travel. After all, you talk about a journey. You talk about what purpose or thread it has. With fiction, it's much harder. This is a book about, well, it's set in an apartment block that is on fire. It's perhaps, if you like to be rather pompous about it, it's a sort of metaphor for death. There are six tenants there and a landlord. They all have different passions and obsessions. There's a failed priest whose values are spiritual. There's a neurosurgeon whose values are materialistic. There's a woman, a lepidopterist, and so on. And I suppose at the end of the book, there is or should be a feeling that actually all these personalities, these characters, are aspects of the landlord. It's as if there is only one person there. And so they're all, if you like, the possibilities of a life that might be led or of ways we might have been had our lives been otherwise, had we loved differently or behaved differently. So it's a complex book in many ways, but it's driven by narrative. It's driven, I think, by the lives, the apparently different lives of six different people.
One of the final chapters in there is the traveller, and in order to, I'm not giving anything away here, but in order to save some of the things that he's collected along the way, they get chucked out of the window. I wonder, souvenirs, are you a souvenir collector? Have you got a house full of things from your travels?
No, almost nothing. I like things in place, and the place for me has always been somewhere out there. Also, on a sheerly practical level, I'm usually travelling rough, and to have something that you bought precious in your rucksack behind is dicey. So I've never really had that acquisitive feeling at all, for better or worse.
So it's all up here?
Mainly forgotten.
So I'm not going to ask you whether you prefer writing fiction or travel more, but I wonder whether the pendulum between them is something that you've come to love and is almost essential for both of them.
Yes, almost always my travel books are alternated with a novel. Nobody much reads the novels.
But they are very good.
Yes, I like it, because I think if I had to write one travel book after another, I would miss that impulse I have, which I need to write a travel book. I really need to know that this is a book I want to write, that is asking to be written. And that takes time to build up sometimes. You know, I finish a travel book, I feel completely exhausted by it. I think I'll never write again. And then I start to think of a fiction, because the novels come from somewhere very different. The travel books are fascination with what is out there. The novels are more an inspection of what is in here. And so quite a lot of my novels have been actually set in places where people can't travel. One set in a prison, another in a mental hospital, another in the mind of an amnesiac. So they're often sort of anti-travel books, not in this case. But they do sort of seem to... They allow for... Well, writing fiction, it allows for the idea for a new travel book to quietly... assemble. And while I'm writing a travel book, which often takes about 3 years together with research, during that time, it's not, in a way, your personal life is something that you've inspected less. It's not that the novels are strictly autobiographical, but the concerns in them are autobiographical, the passions in them, if you like.
Well, let's open up the floor and see whether other people have got some questions. You might have some questions about particular books or practicalities or places that you're thinking of going where Colin has been before you. There's a question here. Now, do we need this? Oh, you've got another microphone. Well done, Roddy. Thank you.
Thank you. I read, I think, Journey into Cyprus was the first one I read, and I loved it. I haven't read all of your books yet, but I've got a new list. You mentioned about your anticipations of what it might feel like going back to Damascus. You went to Cyprus at a time when things were just on the edge, and now we've got the situation where it's a divided island. And I just wondered what your feelings are about that now, and whether you are hopeful for the process that's going on at the moment, which looks promising for peace. I think, was it the place where you had to eat the sparrow in somebody's house? As well.
Yes.
That has stuck with me all the time. But you were very brave about that.
It's nice to be complimented for eating sparrows. And they're very good. I do remember that. I'm only cautiously hopeful. Most people that I meet rather castigate the Turks for their invasion of Cyprus in 1974. I think it was 2 years after I was there. I can only say in defense of the Turks that the island was busy being ruined by Greek developers, and I must have gone to many villages which were marked on the map, Turkish villages, and they were in ruins. They've been abandoned because it's just the time of Makarios. And so I had some sympathy with the Turkish feeling of being excluded, always being second-rate citizens. I am hopeful, of course, but... not with great optimism.
Thank you. Other questions? Do you stick up your hand? There's one behind you, Roddy. Behind you.
Hello. Thank you for a very interesting talk. I'm just wondering about the nitty-gritty of your travels. All these impressions you gain each day from meeting people and seeing things, do you take detailed notes at the end of each day? One thing. Two, where you mentioned how much you enjoyed staying in the refugee camp and how important that was to you, where do you stay normally in the course of your travels? And how do you get on with food, eating? Do you get sick very often? And so
on. So the practicalities.
Well, an awful lot of questions. You have to eat. You don't eat for enjoyment. You eat for sustenance, just what you can get. It's interesting to eat with families always. Where I stay, again, you can't predict. There's no, you know, discovering hotels in most of the places I'm go to, even now, the internet. So, again, it's part of you feel you're experiencing the country at its roots by just having a little confidence that you're going to land up somewhere where you can sleep. I usually have a sleeping bag in the back of my rucksack if nothing else turns up. But I found almost always, particularly in any Arab country, any Muslim country at all, and in Russia, that you arrive in a small place and somebody will put you up. Your final question, your first question, which was about note-taking. Yes, I don't like it because it makes one so self-conscious about the journey, but I do take very thorough notes. What I've found is that I imagine at the beginning of a journey that I'm going to remember everything. Everything has great new impact. But after a few months, you, of course, don't. And so I have to write everything down, in particular the detail, because if you're going to write the book, it's often the detail that gives life to a description. It's the way somebody's eyebrows met in the middle, or the precise expression they used, or the exact texture or color of that rock in that landscape. So all that detail has to go down in the notebooks, which makes them very vulnerable. By the time you've finished a journey, you've got this little packet of notes, and you'd rather die than lose them or have them confiscated or stolen. And that's been a worry. I haven't yet had them stolen. They were nearly confiscated by the KGB on my first journey in Russia. But luckily, I remember, this is a silly story, but I'd come back by car and arrived at the Soviet, as it was then, Czech border, at a place I knew I was going to be given a bad time because I'd been followed by the KGB for a couple of two or three weeks, I suppose. And when I arrived at this border, it was a horrible little place called Chop, I remember, rather not very encouragingly. The car I was in, they took out the dashboard and the tires. I was stripped and body searched. The camera that I had, all my film was developed. But they were left with my notes. And I just couldn't bear it. I knew he was going to confiscate them, I was pretty sure. And there was this big KGB officer in the bowels of the police station. And he said, have you developed this writing specially? Because my writing's very tiny and illegible even to my wife. And this man thought I'd developed it specially to obscure things. So he then made me read out parts of it. He vaguely saw Odessa. He said, read out about Odessa. So I read. He couldn't read what I'd written, of course, so I left out any dissidents I'd met, just said the birds were singing in the trees in Odessa and the sun was sparkling on the waves. And this went on for about half an hour. And after a bit, he said, this is very poetic, he said. You could publish this. But what I did realize as I was reading it out was that all the detail in those notes were things I'd forgotten. And if he were to confiscate it, which he just didn't, there would be no book.
When you look back through your work, and I don't know, but I'm sure you've still got those notes, do you have a sense that the things, the details that you noticed when you were in the 60s in Damascus are actually different now to the details that you pick up on now as a more experienced writer and traveller?
It's an interesting question. I don't know is the answer. I'm not sure. I think I would actually tend to notice the same things, which is a bit depressing. I obviously haven't developed at all.
Other questions? Yes. Okay, we'll come to you and then we'll come to you in a second.
Hello. I'm a tour guide. Hello, I'm here. I do a lot of reading, but I read like an undergraduate, a paragraph here, a chapter there. So I have to admit I've not read an entire book, nor any of yours, I'm sorry. But I'm fascinated by your desire to understand a place and get the character of it. And also when you said, somebody asked you the difference between traveling to a place and getting to a place. And I wondered whether you found there was any difference between understanding a place and the time of the place. And I was wondering if you thought there was any place in the world, or any time that was you could get the most out of by travelling in conjunction with concentrating on a particular time.
In terms of time and a place to get there.
It might be difficult to separate. I've given you a very difficult question. I'm interested in what time would give one the most to get out of if one went to go look for a time.
Ooh, well, it's always been a concern, of course. I've often found that disasters seem to happen after I've left a place, which is rather encouraging if I've caused them, rather like the Turkish invasion of Cyprus, or when I was in Lebanon, the Six-Day War broke out. It's usually been a matter of, in my case, of accessibility, the desire to be sure I can get into a place. And that has altered my way of travelling occasionally. With the book I wrote on the Silk Road about 10 years ago, I wanted to go through northern Afghanistan, and I realised I couldn't at that stage because warlords were fighting. I had to delay and go back the next year where things had calmed down a bit. Those sort of things are really the only thing that's dictated the times that I go, because I tend to be an obsessive and I want to go somewhere, so that's the place I'm going to go anywhere. And it's just a matter of sometimes of nuancing the time. But I've been caught out. I was caught in the Lebanon by the Six-Day War, walking in the Bekaa Valley. So I'm not very politically strategic about when I go to places.
Here's a question here.
You mentioned that sometimes you don't realise the destination or theme of a journey until after the event. And I was wondering if you're able to say what you took away or what resonated with you the most from your travels to Kailash.
With Kailash, I think there might be an expectation in the book that I'd had some sort of epiphany or conversion. After all, here I was, an agnostic, travelling to a site of great sanctity in a state of some kind of mourning. I don't think that I took anything very definite away I can talk about, except a feeling of the lessened importance of the individual. In the Buddhist Hindu world, there's no sense of the value of the individual per se. There's a sense of the importance of good and evil, of karma that continues after you. But I was going with the obsession of the afterlife. After all, I was mourning people I loved. And that was not resolved. I think all I did feel was that perhaps the individual life mattered less than I thought, including my own. And I think in that way, Hindu Buddhism gives a more expansive view of human destiny and human life than, say, the Abrahamic religions, Christianity, Islam. It's another tradition. And it was a little bit helpful to me. But that's all.
And on that very profound note, I think we've just about run out of time. So if I can see from people's faces that you love Colin's travel books, there are lots of those over at Stamford's. But if you've not read any of his fiction before, this is a wonderful place to start because it's got so much travel in it as well. So Colin will be doing signings over at the Stamford's stand. You can go and carry on the conversation there. Thank you to you for being here and for some great questions. Most of all, thank you to Colin Thubron.